We made this.
Then why are we chasing it?
It's bold and dangerous. And about 30 seconds from the centre of London.
What's that mean, Mummy?
You mustn't let him touch her.
Are you a doctor?
I have my moments.
They've all got the same injuries. Right down to the scar on the back of the hand.
Physical injuries as plague.
Hello.
Hello. Shall we have a drink on the balcony?
Oh! I like to think of myself as a criminal.
I bet you do.
TARDIS Crew, a Doc 2 podcast for the We Made This podcast network. I'm Baz Greenland, and I'm joined as usual in my adventure through time and space by my son Ben, the biggest Doc 2 fan this side of Gallifrey. How are you today, Ben?
Yeah, doing pretty well, thank you.
Excellent. So today we are tackling our first ninth Doctor story, and we're going with the pretty amazing The Empty Child, The Doctor Dances, the two-parter from 2005, written by Stephen Moffat. So, Ben, are you a big Ninth Doctor fan?
Moderately, I'd say. Like, if I were to go on my ranking, him and Tennant, they swap around quite a bit, those two. They're, like, around 9th and 10th places at the moment, ironically enough. I could probably work it out if I went through it, but just based on surface level.
Yeah, we've done our Doctor Who rankings before, so I think we'll...
Not sure we ever did rank the Doctors.
But... I'm not sure we have. I mean, it's always changed. I think that's the whole point, isn't it? It depends on your mood and depends on the story of which Doctor is... Obviously, you've got your favourites, but also some of the ones, it depends on kind of just what your mood is on that day.
Yeah, like, I know... Davison moves up and down depending how I feel. Eccleston and Tennant swap around quite a bit. And...
Yeah. No, it's great. I mean, obviously, he only had one series as a Doctor back in 2005, so just before you were born. So, obviously, you were born in 2006. David Tennant had recently become the 10th Doctor, so Eccleston is technically one of those Doctors before you were born.
He is, yeah, which... feels somewhat weird, somewhat not. But then again, these days, he is the Doctor while I'm alive, so...
Absolutely, yeah. So, obviously, he's come back recently on Big Finish as well. Are you a big fan of the Big Finish Doctors with Christopher Eccleston as the Ninth Doctor?
They're decent. A bit like the Fourth Doctor stories, I feel that a lot of them are quite average. They're just good. Like, there's one which I really love... and one which I'm really not a fan of. And other than that, they're all just, yeah, this was fun to listen to. I had a good time.
Yeah, well, I think the biggest thing with the Ninth Doctor Big Finish audios is that they seem to capture the spirit of 2005.2 and Eccleston particularly. The fact that he hasn't played the Doctor since 2005 isn't really apparent when he's voicing him on those audios.
Yeah. And it's interesting as well, seeing without Rose... Which I feel where we're at now, they could probably do with doing some Rose stories with him, because the novelty of Nine on his own, which I did really enjoy, I feel that's worn off a bit slightly these days. And also needing to do a bit more of the Time War angstiness of Nine, because I haven't really leaned into that, I believe, because Eccleston himself didn't really want to use that aspect of the character as much in these stories.
Yeah, but I think he's just having fun playing the Doctor. I think they do suffer from not having... at least a companion across the each box has four stories, so it'd be good.
Has three stories.
So it's a shame sometimes we don't necessarily get a companion for like three stories. You've had a little bit in the first one, Ravagers, but
yeah, although that was basically one big story.
But I would like, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because you don't want to take away from Rose was the companion that got the Doctor back on track, being a Doctor properly, you know, as we know him now, as we knew him before as well, but. I kind of feel like the lack of a recurring character for a Doctor to bounce off is a little bit of an issue in those stories, but they are still fun overall.
Oh, yeah, and there's definitely been a few stories where it's like, oh, this could have been a great companion, but alas not. Perhaps maybe later down the line they'll bring one of them back to go with the 11th Doctor or 12th or 10th or something, whether that be Matt Smith or Jacob Dutman's. Who knows?
Yeah, we'll see if Matt Smith does do some big finish. But yeah, no, they are good. There are some good ones. I really love the one with the Cybermen on the set of Metropolis.
Yeah, that was my favourite one. Yeah. That was really good.
And the stuff with the Brigadier as well, because obviously we didn't get the Brigadier on Modern Doctor Who. Yeah, we don't need Sarah Jane, wasn't
we? I believe Ten and the Brigadier were going to meet in Wedding of Sarah Jane Smith, I think it was.
Right.
But alas, like, things happened and they never did, which is a shame.
It's a shame. I think John Coltrane's doing a really good job with the Brigadier, and I thought the stuff with the Brigadier and the Doctor, and both being war heroes, that was a nice little tap into the Time War stuff there, I thought worked quite well.
They touch upon that in another comic where Nine and the Brigadier meet, although this is, like, proper unit Brigadier. Harry Sullivan's there, Benton's there, and, like, the Brigadier's like, there's something different about this version of you. You seem like you've gone through something, and he, obviously, being the Ninth Doctor, he doesn't really want to talk about it, but it is there.
But it's good that we're getting some more Ninth Doctor, and that's what Big Finish does. Obviously, it brings back Doctors and gives them some really, really good material to work from.
Yeah, I mean, we have had Ninth Doctor stuff on there before with Nick Briggs' impression, which is something.
It's okay. He's not one of his best. He does some better impressions, I think.
Yeah, and then they got Dudman briefly for Nine. I feel his Nine and his 11 are the best ones, but I think they only used him once with Nine some short trips, and then the man himself came back, so he's been relegated to Smith and Capaldi duty, which I'm fine with. His Smith is impeccable.
He's very, very good, isn't it? So let's talk about the 2005 series then. So obviously I remember the buzz when Doctor Who came back, and this is obviously just before you were born, so I remember lots of friends coming around and watching every week and really enjoying it. And I'd seen some Sylvester McCoy stories as a kid. I didn't really remember them that well, and obviously in the TV movie with Paul McGann, but this was where a lot of people got into Doctor Who, and I guess where I got into Doctor Who, I say I'd seen little bits, but I became a fan of Doctor Who through the 2005 series.
And I'm not sure if this is where he became a fan, but I know he definitely grew up watching it, of the new Doctor, Shuti Gatwa.
Yeah.
He's a child of the revival. I think born in the wilderness in the 90s, which will make some of you feel very old. The new Doctor was born in the 1990s.
Yeah, that certainly does, but we'll leave it there, shall we?
Yeah.
So, what do you think of the 2005 series? What are some of your kind of favourite moments of of that first series of Doctor Who in the revival?
Well, I mean, overall with Series 1, I know, like, it's one of the most favoured series of Doctor Who, at least in the revival, though these days the reputation of some of the cast members in the RTD era, very much this series as well, has been tarnished quite a bit.
Yeah.
Which is a shame. But the quality of the stories, they still remain.
Yeah, I always found the Slovene ones, particularly the Slovene two-parted, a little bit too hokey for my liking. But I really like the one when she comes back as the mayor of Cardiff.
I feel I like half of that one, and then once they've captured her, it goes a bit down. But I feel that's probably the most cursed episode in the series. You have two of the problematic cast in one.
Well, you do, absolutely, yeah.
But I mean, in terms of how I feel about the series, it isn't one of my favourites, which I'll probably get a bit of flack for. It's around mid on my series ranking, I think, but recently RTD era stories have slightly gone down in appreciation for them, but they're still brilliant.
Yeah.
And this has got some cracking stories in it.
It does. Now, I think it's a really, really good first run for bringing Doctor Who back. And, you know, it has the almighty Dalek in there. I think there are things that are dated, like the whole Weakest Link stuff in the penultimate episode. But again, that two-part finale is great fun too. And this one, I mean, we've gone with this as our first Ninth Doctor story because it really, really is a great one. For me, The Empty Child and the Doctor Dances is my favourite story of any form so far for the Ninth Doctor.
Yeah, I find it hard to disagree there. Actually, no. There is a book which is my favourite Ninth Doctor story, and there's also the aforementioned audio with the Cybermen on the movie set, but I think those two and this are my top three Ninth Doctor stories in any medium.
Definitely. And it's also the first script written by Stephen Moffat, obviously, who would be the fan favourite. Well, for Moffat, obviously, he did The Curse of Fatal Death.
But yeah.
In terms of canon Doctor, shall we say.
Well, I mean, he did write a short story or two in the Wilderness years, I believe. Like, I know he's done one for the Seventh Doctor.
Yeah, but in terms of TV, in terms of TV, that's canon, yeah. Yeah. Obviously, we talked about last time how he canonised the Peter Cushing Doctor Who movies we talked about last time as the Doctor's watching them in Day of the Doctor. So I mean, it all ties in, doesn't it?
To be fair, Curse of Fatal Death was going to be like the official continuation at one point of the series of books planned for Joanna Lumley's Doctor.
Yeah.
And then I know also there's like something where Rowan Atkinson's Doctor actually is canon, and so is Richard E. Grant's Shalka Doctor, and so is Christopher Eccleston's. There's apparently three Ninth Doctors canonically in existence, so yeah, we'll just go with it because it's Doctor Who. Canon is an irrelevant construct.
It's a manable construct, certainly, isn't it? Yeah. But yeah, I think this is a great story. I mean, it's a great Stephen Moffat story. It's got all the magic of his scripts as well. And he was a fan favourite in the Ross T. Davies era, which is why I think he was a natural successor to take over in Doctor Who as showrunner after Ross T. Davies left and did some of my absolute favourite Doctor Who stories. But I think this is also one of my favourites. It's there's a lot of wit and charm to it. There are lots of different plates spinning in this story as well. It's ridiculously fun. It's scary. It's got that kind of trademark taking something quite normal and making it quite scary, which Moffat does very, very well. And it also has a dynamic of Rose, Jack and the Doctor, which actually I really liked. And obviously, I know there's the stuff from John Barrowman aside that's been debated many times. But actually, I watching this again, I really wish we'd had two or three more standalone stories with the Ninth Doctor, Rose and Jack. I think they work really well together.
Yeah, I mean, I know they're in a few books and comics together, but in terms of actual full cast audios or TV, that hasn't ever happened. And I mean, even if there wasn't the whole Barrowman fiasco, it wouldn't happen anyway, because Christopher Eccleston, he does not like John Barrowman.
No.
Not sure if Barrowman despises Eccleston, but I know Eccleston certainly despises Barrowman. That and the monarchy. Those are the two things he despises.
Let's delve into The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances. So The Empty Child aired on the 21st of May 2005, and The Doctor Dances a week later on the 28th of May. It's the second two-parter in modern Doctor Who. It was written by Stephen Moffat and directed by James Horse. It features the debut of John Barrowman as Captain Jack Harkness as the Ninth Doctor and Rose land in World War II London in search of a crashed alien warship.
Well, yeah, warship, ambulance.
It's up for debate, isn't it? So, I mean, in the context of the story.
Well, I mean, as Jack says, there are ambulances in wars.
Yeah. So, let's go from the beginning then. So, I think it's got a really, really strong start. There's a lot of atmosphere packed into both these stories, actually, particularly around the gas mask child. We see the gas mask child on the rooftops there against the moonlight, shouting, "Mummy, are you my mummy?" And immediately kind of sets the scene for the kind of, because there's a lot of creep factor to the story, isn't there?
Yeah, this is probably the first one. I mean, you could argue Unquiet Dead as well, but this is probably the first one of the series that properly terrified children, like, nope. And immediately, you have Moffat taking one word from every day and turning it into horror. Like, mummy, blink, listen, all those kind of things. He just takes and he turns on the head.
Well, that's it. The idea of an adorable little child, and obviously the gas mask there is quite a frightening thing anyway. But yeah, he really, really makes it creepy. And James Hall's really, I think his direction in this story is fantastic. The way he packs in the atmosphere and the shadows and the moonlight and stuff, it's really, really, really creepy.
You get the sense right from the start. Like, it starts off, ooh, we've got the action here in the TARDIS, and then we go, ooh, now we're in the atmospheric dark streets, the alleyways.
Well, absolutely. And little things like when the Doctor's alone and he meets Nancy in the alleyway, and then the TARDIS phone rings on the outside, which is never done before. It's like, it doesn't even work. And yet you get that, don't answer it, and the mummy, are you my mummy?
Yeah, which is interesting, because obviously later on, it is a working phone. Like, you have Time Heist, where it's called an Time of the Doctor. He leans out of the TARDIS in space and grabs it and talks to Clara. So I assume it gets replaced with a proper phone later on, I guess. But yeah, for now, it's a bit of a dummy phone.
Absolutely, yeah. So let's talk about, obviously, there were two main plot threads in this. Obviously, there's Captain Jack and Rose, and then the Ninth Doctor and stuff with Nancy and the Gasmaster Child. So let's talk about Rose to start with. I love the idea of Rose swinging from the rooftops in that Union Jack t-shirt as the bombs go off.
That, oh yeah, just going to test it out. Well, you could have picked better timing.
Yeah, it's a really bombastic and really kind of fun sequence. Ending there, we obviously with Captain Jack saving her with the light in the midair as well. What do you think of those other scenes with Rose and then how it leads to her introduction to Jack?
Yeah, it is very fun, like, because obviously you first see Jack on the balcony, and of course, in true Captain Jack fashion, he gets a flirtatious line as his very first one. And then, yeah, when him and Rose see each other, they've got immediate attraction there, and it's just all really awkward. And
yeah, isn't his first line, excellent bottom?
Yeah, he's just yes. looking at Rose and zooms in on it, which is pure Jack, and also fair enough for Moffat's script.
Oh, very much so.
Moffat should have written more Jack, although I think he was going to be in A Good Man Goes to War at some point, and he was going to get beheaded, and that's how he becomes Face of Bow, which I assume is what Dorium replaced.
Oh, okay.
But that never happened because of Miracle Day conflict scheduling, which...
And Miracle Day isn't that good, so...
Yeah, which is fine. I mean, RTD has retroactively confirmed during, I think it was the watch-along for New Earth and Gridlock in 2020, that Jack is the Face of Bow. He properly outright stated, yep, yes, it... He is, which... It's interesting, then. How does he get to that point? I guess we won't know.
No, well... Oh, well, I like the mystery around that. I like the mystery that at some point he goes from the Jack we know to this giant floating head in a tank.
Yeah, especially as he's meant to be immortal, but I guess at some point the immortality's like, yeah, I'm gone, I'm done with you.
But I'm okay with that. I think there's... I like when there's some mystery.
Yeah, there is a nice sense to it. And it's also quite a nice thread connecting a lot of the RTD era, because... You have Jack in Series 1, Face of Bow in Series 2, both of them in Series 3, and then Jack in Series 4.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. No, it is a nice little Jack arc over the course of the show.
Jack Arkness,
yes, Ben. That's, is that your first pun on this episode?
I think so. 17 minutes in, as of raw recording, it's pretty good.
I mean, I'm sure there'll be more puns to come. So, yeah, I really like, again, that... Moffat does kind of flirty banter quite well. I really like the kind of flirting over the psychic paper and what each of them are thinking as well. I think very Moffat.
Yeah. Poor Mickey. Like, it again reinforces how Rose only really keeps Mickey around because she doesn't have anyone better. And then she meets the Doctor and then she meets Jack and she's like, oh, cool.
Yeah,
cool,
yeah.
Cool. Poor Mickey.
Well, that's it. I think the way she treats him is appalling, but obviously that kind of plays out in the show as well. But no, I think there were... It's really, really fun, these scenes. They're drinking champagne on an invisible spaceship overlooking London during the Blitz. Tethered to Big Ben as well. I love a bit, do you have the time? Then the chimes go off as well. It is very, very fun.
Yeah, second time Big Ben's got a prominent role in Series 1 as well. You get it here, and then obviously earlier in the series, the Slitheen spaceship with a pig smashes into it, destroying it. So that's a shot. That's a shot you see often in that series, actually, in previously.
Yeah.
The wing crashing into Big Ben.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's quite prominent in both the kind of two big parters of this series, certainly. But I think it's really fun. You can tell that John Barrowman and Billy Piper are having a really good time playing those scenes as well. And there's really good chemistry between them.
Oh, yeah, there definitely is there. To be fair, John Barrowman has good chemistry with most people.
Mm.
Although, I guess some of that might be chemistry outside of acting, but again, we won't get into that.
Yeah, but it's fun. They are fun on screen together. Again, when you get him with the Doctor later on as well. And what do you think of the whole kind of the idea of trying to sell the Tudor warship? And he's the one that led the Doctor to them, and there's obviously a deadline before the bomb goes off. There's a lot of kind of a setup there for kind of Jack's storyline.
Yeah, it does feel very Jack for it to start that way. Definitely just like, ooh, a retro time machine. Yes, let's con them. They're definitely time agents. And it is really interesting looking at overall Jack's arc and how it goes from this to Children of Earth to Miracle Day. And I believe he does some bad things in the continuation on Big Finish.
Mm.
It just goes to show, even from the get-go, he does cause problems. He is not He's not like the Doctor. He doesn't just solve everything. He can be the mistake.
Yeah, absolutely.
That happens and causes the tension and the drama here.
Well, I think that's the one thing with Captain John Hart in the second series of Torchwood.
Yes.
They kind of show that's his past, that showed the kind of person he was. Definitely, because, yeah, I think the thing about Barrowman, particularly in his early ones, he is so much charm in the role that he's almost like, I think in this two parts, certainly, and certainly in series one of the new Doctor Who, he's kind of that Han Solo roguish type character who's a little bit bad but quite fun and quite charming and everyone kind of likes him at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. And it's just a shame how things have turned out, which we probably won't get more of Barrowman.
Yeah.
Or even Jack itself, because they cancelled just a comic with Captain Jack that was going to tie into Flux because of all the behind the scenes stuff, which I don't think is very fair. Just get rid of Barrowman, sure, but not the character. Because it's a separate the art from the artist situation. Because even despite everything, I still really love Jack's character.
I think he's very, very
Yeah,
fun,
I can watch him comfortably.
Yeah, yeah. So, obviously, there's a lot of kind of banter and electricity going on between Rose and Jack. So what about the stuff then with the Ninth Doctor and Nancy then?
Yeah, that's definitely where the creepiness comes in. It's also probably one of Nine's more playful stories in a way. Like when he starts off, he goes in to just ask about the bomb, sees the air raid signs, just like, oh, for goodness sake. And then
yeah, I like the scene when he goes into that club and goes, has anyone seen a bomb or anything that's landed in London?
Fallen from the sky recently.
Yeah, fallen from the sky recently, and of course not realizing they're in the middle of the Blitz, so that you get that laughter, they think he's a comedy act.
Yeah, and then you get him talking to the cat, which is a very Doctor thing to do. I quite like that. And then when he infiltrates the meal and just like, it's just like, thanks miss, he just takes the two. It's like, where did he come from a shot ago? He was not there. He is very fast.
No, it is fun. I really like his very different chemistry with Florence Hoth as Nancy. I think she's really, really good in this two-parter. I think Nancy is the heart of this story, certainly.
It's a shame, because I believe she's retired from acting by now. It's a shame, although hopefully maybe at one point Big Finish could tempt her back for a story or two. Like, they originally did the Chronicles range and got a few actors back from each era. They could have done one with Nancy. That would have been...
Yeah, she hasn't done anything since 2008, so...
Yeah, she did leave after that, but her and Eccleston have a great dynamic.
They really like... I like this kind of how they're constantly unsure of each other. And I like that... I mean, she's got a lot of strength to her. The way she kind of rallies the kids and she stands up to the guy who they steal the food from in the house as well.
Oh, yeah, the blackmail scene. That is brilliant.
Yeah, and she's really, really good. But she's obviously got that kind of sadness as well. See, with Jamie, who at this point it suggests that it's her brother, who died in the Blitz as well. And
Yeah, she's also the emotional core of the story. And it's like she knows what's going on, and like it's basically the other cast members, they're just trying to play catch up, work out from Jack how the thing started and then from Nancy what it's done and how it can be solved.
Yeah, and I think through her as well we get lots of really creepy scenes, like the gas mask kid's hand coming through the door and knocking on, are you my mummy, as he tries to get through, and then the phone ringing as well, and the radio. Again, this episode really adds up the creep factor.
And that monkey. I do not like that monkey. That simple monkey. It is terrifying. I do not like the monkey. Although, points on the creep factor for it.
Yeah, I think it's been, you were traumatised by the monkey ever since you saw Toy Story 3, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not traumatised by it. I just despise it. It is an evil creature. It scared me as a child. I do not want it. And why did Big Finish put it on the cover of one of their audios?
Oh, dear. Right, so we need some creepy monkey with symbols in a lot sooner, yeah?
I mean, to be fair, it works. It symbolises, like...
It will get you behind the sofa.
I mean, even without Toy Story 3, just look at it, the dead eyes. It is already a freaky merchandise.
Well, I think in this story, I'm going to go out on a limb and say the gas mask kid, all the gas mask people, zombies, they're a little more creepy than the
monkey. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, but the monkey definitely helps.
Yeah. Well, I love the... moving on from the Ben's monkey trauma, we've obviously got the stuff when they go to when Dr. Voss and Nancy to the hospital. And I think this is when it really kind of kicks up a gear as well. And you see Dr. Constantine as well. And you discover all those bodies in the wards, all wearing the gas masks, but they aren't actually gas masks. They're part. They're kind of flesh and bone. They're actually part of them.
Yeah, and they aren't dead either. And talking to the other doctor, and it's like, you know, something's happened. And then as soon as you see the scar on his hand, you have the dread there. And there's also a really nice moment where Constantine's saying, like, before this war, I was a father and a grandfather. Now I'm neither, but I'm still a doctor. Mm-hmm. And then the doctor says, I know the feeling, which I do really like that line. It just helps, like, what the Time War has done to him.
Mm, definitely. When she says, I'm going to take you to the doctor, the first time I'm watching, thinking, are they actually going to do another doctor here? It's hard to say, like, because you've obviously watched it in kind of retrospect and seen other Doctor Who stories. Did you, when you first watched this story, did you ever think, oh, you know, is that a hint at there's going to be another Doctor as opposed to just a Doctor?
I mean, I don't really remember when I first watched this one, but I don't believe I did at the time. I was probably quite young. Well, I say quite young. It's probably one of the stories you held me off from a bit longer, just so I was old enough to not be absolutely terrified out of my skin, like The Flood.
Yes.
I did not like that jump scare.
Yeah, we never got through Walls of Mars first time around when you were a kid.
No, it was when Andy's biting into the carrot and then he's just standing there.
Yeah.
And then he just turns around and roars. So I was like, no.
We were working on what the limits were. Like, you didn't watch Weeping Angels until a bit later, did you?
So. I know, you didn't. I think Night Terror was my last Matt Smith one. And I didn't watch Under the Lake and Before the Flood for a while. I think that was the last Capaldi one I was yet to watch.
Yeah, so obviously it live. It's good, but they were great. There are, you know, we talked about the idea of hiding behind the sofa thing of Doctor Who. I think it's episodes like The Weeping Angels and The Flood and stuff, but also this one. I think this is a proper. This is going to scare little kids.
Yeah, I think The Unquiet Dead is probably scary, but this has the added addition of unsettling as well.
Very much so, yeah.
And it's like it's going to take. Like Moffat does, not just the one word, as I mentioned earlier, but just an everyday, well, not everyday these days, item that you recognise and turn it into something terrifying, like the Weeping Angels and the gas mask. Like, when I see a gas mask, of course I'm going to pick it up and pretend to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course I am. Who wouldn't?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, again, Richard Wilson is another great actor on this two-parter as well. It's a really, really good cast, actually. And, that scene when the doctor inspects the body, it's got the wounds and it's got the scar on the hand, and then he goes to the other bodies and they're all exactly the same. It really is creepy and unsettling. And the way they all sit up in unison as well. It's very unsettling. I think you actually tagged it. It's very unsettling. What do you think of the moment when Dr. Constantine transforms, though, and his face becomes a gas mask?
That is basically like, hello, kids. If you're not scared enough already, I'm going to make sure you have nightmares tonight. Because, like, the transformation itself is just...
It looks like, painful.
I know. But also, you hear the rubber of the mask, and I think that really adds to it. And then the eyes, and then it's just all saying, like, the... Mm. I think later on they mention the feeling warming up your throat, and then the mouse just contorting into it. I think when I... It might have been the first or second time when I was watching this... I, for some reason, whatever, I think I went to talk to you or whatever, paused the TV during the transformation. So his eyes were the gas mask eyes. So it was just huge bulbous eyes and a bit of the gas mask in his mouth. And it was like, oh, wow, that's a terrifying shot.
It really is. It really is. Again, I've mentioned it on a previous Doctor as well. It reminds me a little bit of that kind of body horror, which you haven't seen yet, because you're a bit too young for it still, but an American Werewolf in London, when there's a transformation on it, and the way his body contorts, and the way Dr. Constantine's face contorts, it feels painful. You can almost feel the bones cracking and everything transforming as it adds.
I think in a transformation like this, I think, by what you described that as, and what this does, having a noise of, like, bones or the rubble or something really adds to it. It's like, ooh, yeah, that is not nice. And the doctor's expression, like, oh, God.
Yeah, it really is. It's like, it's... You don't see it coming. Even though they've got those gas masks on, the idea of actually seeing this transformation is so, so unsettling. It is really, really... I think it's the... probably biggest moment of horror, certainly in Eccleston's series of Doctor Who.
Yeah, probably. I mean, later on in the second episode, I remember, like, you are about to see someone change, but then it cuts away. And then, just to not take away the impact of this, when someone else does change, it's like a side view and you just see their mouth coming out a bit, but you don't see the full thing to retain what this had the effect of.
Yeah, it's definitely a very, very memorable moment of horror in the show, definitely. Obviously, it all comes together then in the first part. Jack meets Doctor. Pleased to meet you, Mrs. Spock. I really like that line as well.
Yeah, just the running gag of, give me Spock, scan for alien tech. Like, how would Rose know if she met Spock? I mean, the Doctor's met Spock, so maybe he told her about him.
Maybe, yeah. But yeah, I really like, and it really plays out more in the second one as well, is the, I like Rose's thought process on what it's like to be the Doctor. You know, why couldn't you be more like Spock? Why can't you be more scientific? Why can't you explain what's going on? She used the line here, and it's been used several times, and Moffat likes to use it a lot, and sometimes it's overplayed, but when she goes Doctor Who in this, it's not like, oh, look, we've used the title of the show. It actually, it really works for me.
Yeah, and he's just like, oh, 900 years, I've got by just fine.
Yeah. But yeah, obviously, it all comes together. You find out that it's Tula Ambulance, and it was bait for the Doctor, and Jack's the con man, and then the idea of human DNA being written. So I think by the end of the first episode, you've got the stakes of what's happening. You've got this ticking time bomb, this bomb that's going to explode on the Tula Ambulance. People being transformed. You've had this horrific transformation, the idea of don't touch them or you'll become part of them. And I think when you get that kind of that cliffhanger with Nancy in the house with the gas mask kid and all the patients waking up going, mummy, as they close in on Dr. Rose and Jack, I think that's, for me, is a really, really good cliffhanger.
Oh, yeah, it's possibly one of Moffat's best. Mm. Like, as well, seeing the POV of the gas mask as well, like, just looking at the Doctor. I like it when things do that, like when you see the Doctor through Dalek eye stalks.
Yes.
As well, having things like that, and it's just the complete crescendo of, I think that's the right word, of them all saying it at once, and it just cuts to all the different faces as the theme just cuts in. It's like,
it's good, and because I think that's one thing I missed from Modern Doctor 2 compared to Classic Doctor 2, you know, even though stories could be stretched out over 6 or 7 or even 8, even sometimes even 10 episodes.
12, 14. Yeah. Well, 14's debatable, depending how you count trial.
You'd easily get 4 parts or 6 parts, and some of those were stretched far too thin, and you'd get an episode where they just walk around and run around and do the exact same thing you did 3 episodes ago. But the one thing that Classic Doctor 2 always had going for it was those great cliffhangers.
Mostly. Sometimes you just get the end of episode one. You're a spy. I'm going to execute you now. Boom, boom. Or there's two other ones. There's Death to the Daleks. It's like, stop. And it just zooms in on a floor. That one in episode three. Terrible. But then obviously there's the iconic face it Tegan. He's drowned even though he's been in the water for 2 seconds.
Yeah. Oh, not all the time, but sometimes you could have some really great cliffhangers.
Oh, and Dragonfire.
Hanging on with the
For no apparent reason.
All right, but my point was, Ben, before you kind of ruined it by examples of really, really terrible cliffhangers.
Boy, they're iconic.
Well, they're something. Is that Doctor Who, because it was multiple part stories, every week was a cliffhanger.
Mm.
And sometimes they were terrible, absolutely. But sometimes they were really great as well. And I love cliffhangers if they're done well, because they raise the stake of what's going to happen next. The thing about modern Doctor Who is that you get one or two, maybe three, two parts in the series, but the rest are standalone episodes. So you don't get the weekly cliffhanger all the time. And I think, this is the approach they took with modernising Doctor Who and following the coming of the Buffy format and everything that Ross Stewart was doing with Doctor Who, actually I think it was the right decision. The one thing that it does lose by moving away from the classic model are those weekly cliffhangers. So when you get a two-part like this, you want to make them work. I'm trying to remember what the Slovene one was earlier in the series.
They were electrocuting everyone, including the Doctor, because of the lanyards on.
So, again, a decent cliffhanger. So you have two cliffhangers mid-season. I think, actually, the penultimate episode cliffhanger is
pretty
good.
Yeah, Bad Wolf with Doctor. I was just thinking, like, I don't think there's really a bad cliffhanger until, arguably, Daleks in Manhattan, maybe? Although even that's got a bit of shock factor.
Yeah, definitely.
Most of the RTD ones actually really land. Like, Series 1, they're brilliant. Then you have Series 2 with, like, ooh, what's in the pit? And, wait, Daleks versus Cybermen? And then the Bride appearing? And
yeah, those are some good cliffhangers, absolutely. So this is for me, is probably one of the, I mean, there were three really good cliffhangers, actually, in the first series of Doctor Who, and this is definitely a great one.
Possibly the best one of the series, although that can be debated with, ooh, the Daleks, and the Doctor just going, no,
Yeah.
I'm not going to let you do this.
All right. So obviously the thing about a good cliffhanger is, are the resolutions in the next part always going to be a satisfying payoff for that cliffhanger?
I mean, even if not, like, I think sometimes Flux did stuff like that. Like, I can remember Halloween Apocalypse and then War of the Sontarans just sort of starts a bit later and you just sort of inferred what happened, but you don't really see. But sometimes that can ruin a cliffhanger, sometimes not. Yeah. But in this case, the resolution, I think, really stuck with it.
Yeah. So what do you think of the Doctor... So we're going to move into part two on Doctor Dances. What do you think of the Doctor saying, go to your room?
Yeah, it's just doing that. Go to your room! And then all the zombies just stop and the gas mask child, like, tilting his head like he's really sad. I am very angry with you. Go away. Yeah. And then they'll do it. And then he's just like, oh, really glad that worked. Those would have been terrible last words.
That was a great bit.
Like, that's amazing. And I also like how sometimes with cliffhangers, it'll do show previously and then it'll go to the title sequence or just vanish, but this just led straight on.
Eccleston is really, really good in this story. I mean, I think he's really good overall. He's got that kind of manic energy, but can have that kind of depth and gravitas too. I think he's got it all in this story though, and I think he's fun because he has that trauma of the Time War. Sometimes it's, you think of him being a traumatized Doctor, and actually it's not always the case. And in stories like this, He's just got so much energy to him. It's so infectious to watch. And you see it more in the second half as well. But I love the way he reacts to that and goes, I'm so glad that worked. It would have been terrible last words. Because that is just so self-referential, very Moffat in the dialogue. But, you know, really, really gets to the heart of who this Doctor is.
And I think had Eccleston had more like this, where he just got to do this much and show this much, he probably would be a bit higher up on the Doctors. Is that my bias for Moffat showing? Possibly. But yeah, the way he writes Nine is really, really good. I don't think he writes any Doctor bad, honestly.
No, he's very, very good.
He gets the wall.
He does, absolutely, yes.
Even 13 in the short one he wrote.
Yeah, and again, it's a shame that Eccleston didn't come back for Day of the Doctor, because Moffat did have a conversation about him returning for the 50th.
Yeah.
Because you see this story and how he writes the Ninth Doctor, and he gets the gravitas, he gets the character, he gets the depth, he gets the sense of fun, the sense of adventure as well. And it's all in this two-parter. And I would really like to see what he would have done with the Ninth Doctor and how he would have played off the other two.
Yeah, and we probably would have got a bit more deeper Nine in that one rather than more fun here. But I believe Moffat's probably the closest anyone's gotten to making him come back on TV. Like, I think Eccleston said he did really like the story. He did enjoy the script. And I believe at one point Moffat, like, wrote half of it with Eccleston in it. And as he said, with no clue what he'd do if Eccleston said no.
Yeah. Well, he did a marvellous job getting John Hurt, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Well, apparently, I hear he just went, right, who do you want to get in? Wouldn't it be amazing to get John Hurt? Well, okay, let's just ask him now so we can get the no thank you out of the way. And then, ooh, hold on.
We'll talk more about Day of the Doctor next year, won't we? Because we're going to look at all the anniversary specials for the 60th anniversary.
Yeah, we are.
Day of the Doctor will be on there. So, yeah, it'd be good to really delve into that and look at the kind of the development of Day of the Doctor as well as obviously the story itself. But going back to this one then, I think there's one thing I really like in the second half of the overall story in the second episode is the exploration of the Doctor's relationship with both Jack and with Rose. So you get a lot of stuff with Jack in this one, you know, the idea that the morality debate over Jack and his actions and the ideas of Volcano of the Day and what happens as well. What do you think of the stuff between Ninth Doctor and Jack?
Yeah, it is a really nice dynamic, because I think 10 and Jack, they're a bit more, hey, yeah, we're mates together. 9 and Jack can be a bit more at odds together.
Yeah, there's more distrust between them.
And I think that works. Maybe Eccleston never really liked Barrowman anyway, and some of that was undertones of performance.
Possibly. I mean, I like that they continue. I really like, I say, the Ninth Doctor, Jack and Rose together, and we would like the kind of more standalone adventures with them, but there's an edge to their relationship, particularly in this one, but I think it does carry on as well. The idea that, you know, Jack is a con man, and even though Rose is charmed by all of Jack's bluster and suaveness and champagne and Big Ben, the Ninth Doctor's like, yeah, no, actually, you're quite dangerous here, and what you're doing is wrong, and we'll cut through that. So I really like those scenes. I also like how he disarms Jack. Like Jack's got that kind of that ray gun,
the squareness gun.
Yeah, the squareness gun, and he replaces it with a banana. It's great. He just completely, puts Jack off balance.
Yeah, it's like, the weapon factory's villain guard has been destroyed. Oh yeah, I was there once. Yeah, as I said, they were destroyed. Yeah, as I said, once. There's a banana growth there now. Bananas are good.
Yes, it's good. I mean, there is, obviously, this is when you hear that Jack's in the 51st century, which obviously becomes quite prominent. A lot of Moffat stuff, actually, with River Song as well.
I think as well, 51st century is Magnus Greel in Talons of Wang Chiang as well. Okay. So I think 51st century seems to be a weird go-to for Doctor Who writers.
Particularly around time travel, which is why I'm growing this
again,
offshoot.
Like Magnus Greel, he was time travel.
Exactly.
Seer.
So hence, in my book, Forward to the Past, the Lethbridge Stewart book that I wrote, it has the idea of someone kind of potentially kind of creating time travel. And so we purposely set him in the 50th century as a kind of a precursor to what goes on in the 51st onwards.
Now, moving on from that shameless promotion.
Absolutely. Forward to the Past, Candy Jar Books, please go and buy it. Anyway, yes. But if it's my podcast, if I can't talk about my own .2 book, then where am I going to do it?
I mean, we've got a whole episode on that series.
Absolutely, yes. Unit and .2 and Lethbridge Stewart with Andy Frankenmuller and Chris Lynch and Tim Gambrell. So, definitely worth checking that one out as well. Anyway, back to the Doctor dances then. The other thing I really like as well is the Doctor and Rose. And again, it's stuff that continues from the last one, from the Who is the Doctor, the Doctor Who conversation. I really like when they're dancing together and how it builds on their relationship.
Mm. And it is very telling of like Moffat that immediately he has dance as a metaphor as well. It's like, it's the kind of cheekiness he'll do. And it's like subtle enough that it won't put kids off and they'll be like, what's going on here? And parents won't be like,
Well, yeah, there is a lot of double entendre in this one with what dancing is and the idea of these characters dancing as well. You see it later on when Jack distracts the guards and he goes, 51st century kind of guy, there's more flexible when it comes to dancing. It's the way Moffat does that really good because it's fun and simple enough that it's not inappropriate for children, but at the same time, it's got that kind of two levels. So the kind of more mature audience will get kind of what actually the underlying aspects of that conversation too.
He does like to do those subtle innuendos, I notice. Like he has outright stated, The Big Bang is a double title just for what happens in the episode, but also for what happens just after. You learn in A Good Man Goes to War.
Yes, absolutely, yes. Yes, well, you haven't got to Coupling yet, which is a great series from Moffat.
I know of it.
Yeah, the kind of couple you see it in the Clara and Danny Pink stuff. There's that second episode of that series 8 when they go on the date. It's pure Coupling. I love that. But
series episode 4 technically, the second of Danny.
Second, say yes, but yes, that is very Coupling.
Right, okay.
But yeah, yeah, obviously, where there's all that kind of relation and that flirtation and the innuendo and the kind of the double means to what dialogue, you still get a lot of horror, don't you, in this? There's that scene again with the kids and they're in the room and, like, who's typing away?
But before that, like, we get, when they go to the room, like, listening to the tape.
Oh, yes.
About the child, and then they're talking and they're like, what's the sound? Oh, the tape, it ran out 30 seconds ago. And then it's like, well, hold on a minute. And then, boom, there's a child. This is its room, which is a great delivery from Eccleston as well.
It is. It is really great. There's a lot of kind of those teas and twists and moments of heart. Yeah, stuff you're seeing, things like the blink and the angels later on as well, where there's something going in the background which is so mundane, and then you go, ooh, that doesn't feel right, and it'll turn it on its head.
And Moffat being Moffat, like, I think this is an indication of like how good he is at writing, just in general as well, but especially this stuff, that he basically repeats that exact trick 5-10 minutes later with the typewriter.
Yes,
and it's still effective. Had he done it any more, it probably would have started, we're losing effect here. But I think he got it just the right amount.
Definitely, absolutely, yeah. I love the idea that it can affect everyday things. Again, very Moffat-y, yeah. So the idea of the typewriters and the radio, it's not
the monkey.
The monkey, yes, absolutely. It is, again, as you mentioned for the first part, it's so unsettling because it keeps you on edge and you suddenly pay, you almost don't pay attention until it's always too late, and then suddenly something that's happening away, like a typing away or like going on, something goes, actually, that what actually is going on is something so much more dangerous than you actually realise.
Mm. I mean, I really like as well how with the typewriter bit, you know the child's writing a letter to his dad, and then you see he's sitting next to the person talking to Nancy, but you don't really think to look at the boy's face and realise it's the same boy until it's like, well, if Jim's over there, and you're like, oh, he is.
Yeah.
Who's typing? I think, yeah, really works. And as well, there's a line from the Doctor, I think it might have been this episode, could have been episode one, where he's like, it's basically the power of the god given to a small child looking for its mother.
Yes. Yeah, that sums it up perfectly, this two-parter, isn't it? I think that's what's great, because it's taking essentially a child's fear and manifesting it into this kind of real pure horror as well. It's and I think that's it. Moffat gets this is a family show, so it is for children as much as for adults. So it taps into the kind of childhood fears. It's things you're doing that listen as well later on.
Because I guess you've not really got a villain in this. You've got a threat, but if you want to go villain wise. Retroactively, it's kind of Jack.
Well, that's what's really good about it. Yeah, it's a World War II drama. It's kind of a time travel con man, and it's a zombie horror all mixed into one.
Mm. And zombies, well, they're zombies. They don't really think for themselves. Although the Doctor does mention at some point the child will start to realise. But like, you can't blame the nanogenes. They thought that's what people were meant to look like, and it really is just Jack's fault. Like. Well, what do you think was going to be in a Tudor ambulance?
Mm. Well, that's it. It's like he was playing with things he didn't realise, and it's kind of it is Jack's fault. And that's you're right. Jack is kind of the villain, which I like. He obviously gets the redemption and then continues with the Doctor afterwards.
He's always out of his depth. I notice a lot of times, even in Torchwood, he does not fully grasp what's happening. And he just tries to fix things.
But he has a confidence and a swagger that kind of gets him a long way too.
Mm.
Yeah. I think what I really like as well in the second half is how the stakes are raised. Obviously, once you've got the soldier being affected, where Nancy's chained to him, you see that kind of half transformation again. You start to realise that the effect is airborne now, and they're all under threat, and that Jack and Rose and the Doctor could also be infected by the nanogenes too.
Do you think they should have done that? Like one of them be gas masked for a bit.
You could have done, but I guess the trouble is, as soon as you play that card. If you did with Jack, maybe, because at this point you didn't know Jack was going to die, and they tease his death in a different way later on. If you have the Doctor or Rose being infected, though, you know it's going to be reversed.
Mm, and I think, like this, you don't really realise it will be. So, it was probably a smart move to do that, because it would have then taken away from the impact of the ending.
Yeah, because it's so unexpected that everyone lives. I think absolutely
which we'll get
to
that in a minute.
Yeah, you could have had Nancy and you could have had Jack, but it would have been kind of cruel. And then even though it gets reversed, I think actually they played it right. You got Constantine, you got the you get that scene where Nancy's talking to the soldier, which he's chained up as well. She actually talks to him, and you find out he's got a wife, and he's trying to say his wife's name, but he ends up saying mummy and stuff. These innocent people are being affected, with Constantine particularly in the first one. What Richard Wilson does is really good. He's actually established enough of him. You mentioned that kind of father and grandfather no longer, and all that sadness, and he's keeping the good fight, keeping going. You get just enough of who he is to like him, to then turn him into a zombie. And I think the script, the direction, the performance, everything on this one, this is why I like this so much, is because it gets you so much, but it makes you care for these characters, so that when bad things happen, it's horrible. And even those, like the random soldier or Constantine, you get mere moments of them before their transformations, but you get to know who they are before they're transformed.
Like, I think even with Constantine, it was like, oh yeah, I'm just holding it off and keeping on going. And it's like, well, then why does he transform here? But I guess you could think, oh, well, there's someone else here now who's looking into it, trying to fix it, so he needs to pass over.
Yeah, he kind of almost gives up at that point, doesn't he? Mm.
And even the soldier who Jack goes to speak to, like, you know nothing about him. He was briefly in episode one, but you know enough that, oh, even Jack's friend has been taken.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think, yeah, you really get a sense of the stakes being raised. You get the all the zombies being drawn to the crash site. You've got the German bombers on their way, so the whole thing's going to be blown up anyways. Even if they get transformed, they'll probably be blown up by the German air raid as well. Yeah, but also, the fact it's airborne, suddenly the stakes go from, if you get touched, you'll die, to suddenly the entire human race is at stake. And I think that's what I really like. It raises the stake exponentially, but it doesn't feel like it loses the kind of heart of what's going on in the story.
Mm.
Yeah. Well, I think it's shown in the next scene, the scene with Nancy and Rose. I love these character moments in this story. Again, Moffat does it so well with the writing. And again, you've got Billy Piper here and Florence Hoeff doing really, really great work as Rose and Nancy. You know, that kind of the sense of, why would any time traveller come here to this basically hell? And Rose saying, I'm a Londoner, I'm from the future, and actually we're going to win, is a real lovely moment. I think Rose is done so well in Series 1, which why I get frustrated. I find the 10th Doctor and Rose relationship toxic. We've talked about this before. Because she gets so smug and so overconfident in herself, and they become quite toxic together. Whereas here, you can see from that conversation with Nancy, she's learned so much, and she knows she's kind of breaking the rules by telling her. But it's a really lovely scene, and it's a bit of compassion from Rose. You know, she's stronger, she's got the experience, she can offer some comfort in this horrible time, which I think is a lovely scene. And it's a lovely, again, a story as from Rose. Rose is served really well by this story.
Mm. You know, this is the second story in a row, counting this two-part as one story, where Rose technically breaks time rules. Because you're a Father's Day. Mm-hmm. And now she's telling Nancy things. Like, don't tell the Doctor, because the Doctor would probably be like, what have we just gone through?
Hmm.
I know it's hopeful, but come on.
Yeah.
So yeah, you probably wouldn't be a fan of that.
Then, obviously, so the stakes get raised. You've got, I love Eccleston's quiet rage against Jack and the situation that he's caused. I think that's, you mentioned the idea of his God with, like, God, basically, God, God-like powers with a child who wants, he's desperately looking for his mummy. I think this is where this moment is. And the way it's summed up is perfectly. And what do you think of the reveal, though, that Jamie is actually Nancy's son rather than a brother?
Yeah, it is really effective. I'm not sure, like, because obviously I don't remember when I first saw it, if I'd ever twigged that. Mm. I think it's possible that you might.
Again, I think it's Nancy's age. Obviously, she was a child. She was a teenager, 16 or so, when she had Jamie. So she, you know, particularly in that point of time, in the early 1940s, the idea of a 16-year-old having a child was unheard of. You know, she'd been hushed away and the child had been taken into adopted with another family or taken to an orphanage. You know, these things didn't happen, or they didn't happen in public. They did happen, but not to the world. So there is a kind of darker secret behind there as well. But I like it because I think again, it's that human drama against all the horror and the alien threat. And I think when you get that hug between Nancy and Jamie, it really feels earned.
Mm, yeah, definitely. Because also, the way Eccleston does it, like, the Doctor has twigged what's happened. Then he's just slowly like, come on, Nancy, like, tell us, we need to know.
Mm. Yeah, and that kind of desperate plea that she's the mother. Come on, if you recognise she's the mother, she is the kind of overriding DNA, not this gas mask, you know. And that desperation to actually, for the nanogenes to work and click, actually, Jamie's biologically like Nancy, not like this scarred child of the gas mask they saw when they first resurrected him. What do you think of Jack's suicide mission then, riding the bomb as he goes off and his goodbye to Rose and the Doctor?
Yeah, the Doctor's kind of like, I guess he might be a bit regretful, but he's also like, well, this is your fault, you need to kind of fix this, so do that. And then Rose is like, oh, she's sad.
Yeah, but I love the T-shirt line as well.
He vanishes, like, oop, by the way, I love the T-shirt, and then vanishes again.
But I think you're right, clocking on that Jack kind of is the villain of this piece. Not intentionally, but he's essentially the bad guy that caused all this. So it absolutely is a moment of redemption for him. And it gives a bit of warmth to the character, which was played out at the end of the next few episodes as well.
And then obviously the iconic scene.
Everyone lives. It's such a joyous moment, isn't it, though? I love the Everyone Lives, because it could have been so cheesy and so hammy if done wrong. And I think it's played perfectly by Eccleston.
Just the fact that he's had a bit more fun, this story, even though it does get quite dark, and then suddenly he can save everyone because there's no really malign intelligence behind this.
Yeah.
And I wonder if part of the fact he's so happy he saved everyone is because he's also in a war setting right now.
Yes, I think that's exactly it.
Because had it been outside of the war setting, it would have been like, yes, we've saved everyone. But this time, he's in a war, and everyone involved in this situation, he's saved. Well, he kind of saved. I guess he emailed the upgrade, as he said. So he saved them, but then Nancy saved every child and retroactively saved everyone. But they were all saved.
Yeah, it's great. And I think you tap into it. It's a way of dealing with his Time War trauma without going, oh, this is like the Time War. I get it's very subtly done, but when you look into it and you realise that kind of depth, you know, these are people who are in a war, who are dying, who are casualties, and the fact that you can see these people when you couldn't save your own planet. And I know it's kind of reading into it some future stuff as well, but the idea that...
Well, I mean, we do know by this point, his planet was destroyed. I'm not sure if we know he did it or not yet.
No, but yeah, the Time Lords are gone. He's the last of the Time Lords. Everyone died. See, everyone died, and now everyone lives. And I think that is done beautifully in this. Also, as probably my favourite line, it's again Richard Wilson when as Constantine to the woman, he goes over, she goes, my leg's grown back. There is a war on, is it possible you miscounted? I actually love that moment.
Yeah, I love the doctor. He's like, yeah, don't make too big of a deal with it. Just tell them how much of an excellent doctor you are. It's like, because also as well, the people who might have been dying before in the hospital, they've been saved by the nanogenes as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
I feel this is probably the first of the last two big blocks in the Ninth Doctor becoming more fun again, because 10 obviously still has the angst very much, but he's also a lot more easygoing and fun-loving, and I think it's this and beating the Daleks in Parting Ways, which is a shame that his last block through, his like the last thing he needed to properly come back, is also where he has to go.
Yes. Well, that's it. He gets that kind of redemption for himself, and he gets that moment of peace through moments like this, absolutely. And it comes at the cost of his own life. But yeah. I think that's why the 10th Doctor is more easygoing. I think that's what Rossi Davis was going for. You know, the 9th Doctor has all the baggage. And even though the 10 does have his own baggage.
And 11 as well.
And 11, does, yeah. But... And 12. And who won that in a way?
And now 13 as well.
And 13, absolutely. But for the most part, it's about him letting go of his own trauma from the war and his war. So, yeah. What do you think of the final sequence then with Jack in his spaceship and the emergency protocol 417, aka the Martini?
Yeah, it's quite nice. It's very Jack as well, that
very Jack.
In the end of things, he'll be like, oh, fine.
I'm going to die, but I'll go out drinking a martini.
Yeah, obviously, were this later on, Jack, he probably would have sat back there, had the martini anyway, but...
Yeah. But yeah, what do you think of the decision of the... Doctor and Rose to save his life?
I think it is earned, because like, even though he did cause this, I think the Doctor does realise he didn't intend for any of this to happen. He did essentially sacrifice himself to save them from the bomb, although it is interesting how he doesn't immediately think, right then, let's go and get Jack. He's like, oh yes, by the way, Rose, I was Father Christmas, gave you a red bicycle when you were 12. Yes. And then Rose is like, Doctor, what about Jack? And he's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if he would have saved Jack had everyone died.
I don't think he would have, honestly.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he wouldn't necessarily be the cause, but it would be like...
Yeah.
He didn't kill Jack, but...
But, yeah, I like that moment for Jack and his resignation that he's going to die. So, okay, well, I'll go out, I'll have my martini. And then the way the camera pans out and goes through into the TARDIS is a really, really good shot.
Yeah, and the song that's played throughout the episodes.
Absolutely, all the Glenn Miller stuff, absolutely.
And then the dancing at the end.
Absolutely. It's fun, and the Doctor finds a way and finds his dance moves. It's a... It's a wonderful, happy, joyous, but very earned climax, the two-parter.
And of course we get the executioner's line from Jack as well, earlier on. Waking up in bed with his two executioners.
Oh yes, that was
stayed
fun.
In touch, lovely couple. Can't say that about most executioners.
Yeah, that's Moffat and Bowman together is really good.
I wish we'd had more of them together, honestly. Because while Jack does have some ear traits, and sometimes Moffat could go a bit far on some of them, and they probably would have heightened them in each other, they're still a really fun combination.
Yeah. I think their dialogue Moffat's dialogue to Bowman's performance. Is it, in some ways, I'm watching, you know, we've been watching the first two seasons of Torchwood, haven't we, as well?
Yeah.
And going back and watching this, I think this is probably my favourite Jack. This is early Jack. This Jack where he was a little bit roguish, but kind of humbled a little bit by the Doctor. And I actually, again, like as with Rose, I think I prefer, even though obviously the actors didn't get on, I actually quite like the Ninth Doctor with Jack better than him with the Tenth.
That's fair. I feel people say that a lot about things. Oh, yeah, I prefer this one with 9, not 10, yeah. But
yeah,
it does make sense. In that sort of term then, do you prefer Mickey and Jackie with 9 or 10?
I don't know. Again, probably, I kind of actually prefer them with 9. I prefer 10 better when he's with Martha or Donna, to be honest.
Or Wilf. You can't forget Wilf. Wilf is iconic.
Obviously, absolutely iconic Wilf as well. So I'm glad they've kind of brought them back rather than doing a Rose for the 60th.
Oh, yeah.
But now they're fine, but I kind of, again, it works, it's fun, but I think it carries on the diet in a more relaxed manner. I like that the Ninth Doctor is kind of a little bit on edge around Jackie as well. So
yeah, she slaps him.
She does.
And then he calls Mickey an idiot and orders him to blow up Downing Street. So,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Mickey does get better in Series 2. Certainly.
Yeah, but Mickey and Jackie both have a more smooth time with 10.
They do, yeah. But again, I like a little bit of tension with them and everything. So, yeah, I think it's almost like a layover from the Ninth Doctor stuff. So, yeah, I think generally everything Rose and her people, I think, work better with the Ninth Doctor. And I think, yeah, finishing off, I kind of wish this had happened a couple of episodes earlier. So we could have had, not necessarily far as they wouldn't necessarily have worked, but, you know, a couple of more stories where it is the Ninth Doctor and Rose and Jack all just throwing the guides together. I think that again is feels like a winning combination to me.
Yeah, I think it definitely does, because in the books and comics they have, they're a great team as well. Yeah. It's one of the books where Jack's not really written as Jack, he's quite military straight type, which doesn't work, but the other ones,
yeah,
they do really go with.
So any kind of final thoughts on this two-parter or the Ninth Doctor in general before we close off?
I mean, it is probably unlikely to ever see 9 on screen again. Although, I think he once promised to come to the 100th anniversary or something. Just hope RTD's not writing that then.
They'll be getting chipped back here. They'll keep rotating around, won't they?
Yeah, we're getting the three ones over and over and over again. And then they'll resurrect John Nathan Turner from the grave.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this story, you can't really fault it.
No, I think it's just so much fun. It's got everything. It's got Moffat's magic with great direction, great performances. It's just, you know, I think if I could only keep one Ninth Doctor story, it would be this one.
Mm. And as a fun fact, I'm fairly sure the night after this aired, or the night it did air, Moffat was at a convention-y thing, and that's where he met Colin Baker. Not sure if he's met Colin Baker more than once, but I know he did. He said in Doctor Who magazine, and Colin was like, that was a brilliant episode, and Moffat was like, yee!
Very good. And he was invited back and kept writing good episodes.
Yes. Because, yeah, you got, after this, I don't think there's any bad Moffat ones. You've got Girl in the Fireplace, which in the last couple of days has been a bit more soiled.
Why is that?
Sophia Miles, who plays Renette, did apparently a Twitter space, like a safe space,
right,
just outright defending Noel Clark. Clark actually went in there as well. And when some like Doctor Who YouTubers spoke up against them, just got blocked and stuff. So,
okay.
Yeah, all that's right. Fun.
That aside, though, again, I think it's again one of the highlights of Series 2.
Yeah, I know a few people who make a fun jokey ship of Ten and the Horse.
Oh, really?
Ten Horse.
Ten Horse, oh dear.
And then we've got Blink, and we've got Time Crash, and the Library two-parter.
All great. I mean, Blink is a masterpiece.
I don't think there's probably a lacklustre Moffat story. You could argue maybe Time Crash, but that's just a bit of fun.
I think certainly Ross T. Davies, when he was writing under Ross T. Davies .2, yeah, I think every single Moffat story is electric. I think when he writes his own stuff, some are more successful than others.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I'd say with Series 5, like when you get Beast Below, that's probably his first one, but then the rest of the series, I think he wrote some great ones. Like,
well, that's why Series 5 is my favourite.
Yeah, we get 11th Hour, Angels, and Pandorica from him.
Yeah, masterpieces, absolutely. Fab. But yeah, so that we've talked a bit about Moffat, we've talked about Ninth Doctor, so I think that's been a really good discussion and a really good I really enjoyed rewatching these again. And definitely my favourite Ninth Doctor stories. So, what are we discussing next time, Ben?
Well, next time we will be returning for our chat with Rob Valentine, who we talked to a few episodes ago. And coincidentally, we'll be recording later today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Two in one.
Absolutely.
About the influences on Doctor Who from other like franchises and mediums and stuff.
Yeah, so things like Quatermass and Day of the Triffids and Hammer Horror and all that kind of impact on Doctor Who. So that should be a good, fun discussion with writer and producer Rob Valentine. Obviously, of course, most Doctor Who fans will know from Big Finish. So yes, Rob will be back to talk more Doctor Who of us. That'll be our next episode. In the meantime, thanks for joining us. And remember, we are part of the We Made This podcast network. Please subscribe to the TARDIS crew and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We'd really love to hear your thoughts. You can also find us online at Crew TARDIS on Twitter and the TARDIS crew on Instagram. As I said, next time we'll be having Rob Valentine back on to discuss the influences on Doctor Who. So join us again on the TARDIS crew, because somewhere there's danger, somewhere there's injustice, somewhere else the tea is getting cold.